Good morning. Kathleen Shea on behalf of Vincent Melendrez. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. And before I begin, I would like to alert the court that Mr. Melendrez's oldest son is in the audience. And I will begin, I know that there were several issues in this case. I will begin by discussing the violation of Mr. Melendrez's Sixth Amendment right to present a defense unless the court directs me otherwise. Defendants have a constitutional right to present relevant evidence. And when evidence is relevant, the burden is on the state to show that the evidence is so prejudicial that it would disrupt the fact-finding process.
Relevant evidence did the trial court not allow be offered?
The relevant evidence that was excluded here was primarily the evidence regarding the sexting.
Didn't the court simply require a foundation be laid before the evidence would be admitted?
I don't think that there was additional foundation that was required, but yes, what the court was requiring Mr. Melendrez to do was to testify out of order, make a decision before his defense was complete.
Well, if Mr. Melendrez had had some other evidence of his knowledge, he could have satisfied the foundation requirement that way as well, couldn't he?
Well, I think the evidence was relevant regardless of whether or not he explicitly testified that he had knowledge.
So your challenge is that the court misunderstood the relevance of the evidence in making its evidentiary ruling?
That is part of our argument, yes. That it misunderstood that the evidence was relevant regardless of whether Mr. Melendrez testified regarding knowledge.
Well, how would it be relevant if Mr. Melendrez had no knowledge of it?
Well, not that it wouldn't be relevant without that, but that his testimony was not required. Circumstantial evidence is permitted just as direct evidence is.
Recognize that, and that's why I suggested other evidence of his knowledge might have satisfied a foundation requirement. But wasn't the court's ruling that there had to be some evidence of Mr. Melendrez's knowledge before the evidence would be admitted?
Yes. I'm sorry if I misunderstood. Yes, there had to be some evidence.
And what is faulty about that analysis?
I think that it can be inferred. It is circumstantial evidence that RM is taking the stand. She is testifying that all of these restrictions have been put in place against her. The jury can infer that her misbehavior at that same period that is directly related to the discipline that's being imposed demonstrates that this evidence, that actually what her story was, is not credible. That, in fact, the discipline was imposed because of her misbehavior.
There's the step I'm having a little trouble with. If somebody does something because of something, don't they have to know about it?
I think that evidence could have been brought forth. And, in fact, yes, I mean, that evidence could have been brought forth without Mr. Melendrez testifying, for instance, through the son's testimony.
Okay,
but that was precluded.
Was it?
That was precluded. The trial court insisted that Mr. Melendrez testify first.
Well, as I read the record, what the trial court said is Mr. Melendrez had to offer evidence of his knowledge before that evidence came in. And there wasn't any suggestion there was any source of that information besides Mr. Melendrez.
I don't know if that's true. It's true that the trial attorney did not make an explicit proffer. At the same time, there was indication throughout these, I mean, there were multiple discussions here at trial. They talked about it over and over. And during those discussions, I think that there definitely was this sense that these boys had witnessed, the sons had witnessed what had happened and could testify to that.
Did anybody make the trial court ruling based on a sense of something? Did anybody ever tell the trial judge, you know, judge, we don't need to have Mr. Melendrez testify about his knowledge because we have some other evidence of that. Here's what it is. Did that ever occur?
No one ever said that explicitly. But again, even...
Isn't that what needs to happen when you're arguing about evidence? Don't you have to tell the judge, here's what we have to show our foundation?
But I think that even without that, the jury could have made a reasonable inference here that her testimony, RM's testimony, that she was getting penalized in very particular ways was then coinciding with these same events of her misbehavior. So she's claiming these restrictions are being imposed. Her phone is being taken away. She's not being permitted to go outside. At the same time, there is evidence that, in fact, she was sexting. She was having boys over to the house.
I used to know what that was. It was like post hoc ergo proctor hoc or something. I don't remember anymore because I've gotten old. But the principle was that just because something happens after something else, it doesn't it's a logical thing. It isn't established by nature of logic. Isn't that what you're arguing?
No, I don't think that's what I'm arguing. I think there was circumstantial evidence here that, in fact...
Why isn't that just a correlation rather than a causation argument?
Well, and I think the reason that it's not is because the grandmother in particular, we know that the grandmother could have testified because then she did, because Mr. Melendrez was forced to testify before her. And so then the grandmother does testify that these two things are connected. And I think that the brothers... Well,
why couldn't defense counsel have called grandmothers his very first witness and solved all of these evidentiary issues?
Why couldn't the grandmother have been called as the very first witness? I mean, I think that's the fundamental problem here, though. This is the Sixth Amendment right to control your defense.
Well,
Mr. Melendrez was entitled to do that.
Your defense and having to comply with the rules of evidence. Nobody has ever suggested that you can admit evidence under the Sixth Amendment simply because you think it helps your case without a foundation. There's no case that I'm aware of that says requiring a foundation to demonstrate evidence is relevant is unconstitutional.
But there, I would submit to the court that there was that foundation. That foundation wasn't missing. They didn't need it to come directly from Mr. Melendrez. It could have come from the boys. It could have come from the grandmother.
It could have, but it didn't, did it?
I think to some degree it did come from the grandmother. I think that is in the record.
Okay, well, we're back into why didn't grandma get called first? I mean, counsel's supposed to know what the foundation is for presenting evidence.
While it's true, again, that he did not make an explicit proffer, that information was there, that the boys knew about this, that they witnessed these things. And they testified before Mr. Melendrez, so they weren't able to even get into to discuss what the images on the phone were.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Ann Summers on behalf of the State of Washington. I wish to first address the motion for the mistrial, then the nurse's testimony, then the jury instruction regarding unanimity, and then finally the 404B ruling and how it affected the order of testimony, if I have time.
So are you going to then address the last point that was just made, which is the boys did testify first, but they weren't allowed to testify as to the improper behavior of
R.M.? Well, the boys did testify to quite a bit of behavior by the victim,
particularly Daniel. Not sexting.
Well, not sexting, no, but the grandmother testified to sexting.
So the boys testified first, but they weren't allowed to testify as to the sexting?
I don't know if they had knowledge of the sexting. The problem with this record is that, to be honest, I think a fair reading is that defense counsel was being a little cagey about what witnesses were going to offer what evidence of misbehavior. And at some point, you know...
Well, was the victim cross-examined about sexting during the state's case?
I don't remember. But certainly...
Is there any reason why she couldn't have been?
No. And certainly at 1925, the grandmother testifies to seeing those photographs. So that evidence did come in. Yeah. And even though at that point it wasn't even tied up to the defendant, the grandmother didn't testify that she told the defendant about it, but it came in anyway. So you have the 404B ruling, and you also have a lot of evidence coming in sort of outside the 404B ruling because it's a little bit of a moving target for the trial judge. There was plenty of evidence coming in. About the victim's various discipline and what the defense wanted to characterize as misbehavior. Did the trial court abuse its discretion in concluding that a single use of the term jail staff was so prejudicial that it required a mistrial? You know, the question was in regard to scheduling. The trial court, they had 6 days in recess, 6 unscheduled days in recess. The court was concerned about moving the trial along so as not to lose jurors. And he made a comment, is the jail staff able to staff until 4:30 tomorrow? The question was inadvertent.
In hindsight, that's not something the court should be saying in front of the jury.
No, I'm sure he, but it was inadvertent and ambiguous. He did not clearly inform the jury that the defendant was in custody, as in Gonzalez. There was no reference to any kind of restraints or shackling, as in Gonzalez or Hutchinson or Finch. The jury could just as easily conclude that the two officers, uniformed officers, who'd been sitting through trial the entire time and were in full view of the jury, were there to provide courtroom security. That's a very reasonable assumption, and certainly the court's comments wouldn't have made them think anything other than that. And also there was testimony that indicated the defendant had been out of custody since the charges were filed, both from a co-worker and from the grandmother who testified to him coming to California. So the jury had reason to think the defendant was out of custody, and it had no reason to think that the presence of two officers in court were necessarily indicative that he was in custody at that time. So given the totality of the circumstances, it was certainly reasonable within the discretionary standard for the court to conclude that a mistrial was not warranted, a curative instruction was offered and given by the defense, and this court must presume that the jury followed that instruction. Turning to the nurse's testimony, this nurse witness had an enormous amount of experience examining women, both adult women and teenagers. She was presently retired at the time she testified. She'd been a sexual assault nurse for a very long time. She certainly had the expertise to testify about the state of hymens. And the fact that a hymen could remain intact after repeated sexual conduct was relevant and also helpful to the jury, because that's not something that's within the province of the average person. The nurse did not violate the motion in limine. The motion in limine went to her not testifying that she saw anything that was consistent with sexual assault as opposed to sexual activity. And those questions were not asked. But besides, the defense theory was that the victim was sexually active with other people. So it's hard to see how that testimony would have been particularly prejudicial. The third issue, the jury question, the Petridge instruction was properly given. There's no authority that more is required. The jury was told that the state must prove one particular act and they must agree as to what that act is. I simply think the court could not accurately answer the question, do we have to agree on a specific instance? Because no one knows what they mean by specific instance.
Them a little more specifically to where in the instructions they should look.
I don't think that's ever been required.
I mean, it appears that they were having some trouble between several instructions and were confused by them.
Well, so they had the Petridge instruction before them. So I don't think it would error not to say look at instruction 14 or whatever the Petridge instruction was. He said reread the instructions. Because really, they're supposed to read the instructions as a whole. You don't want to overemphasize one instruction. Generally.
No, but if the answer to a particular question is in two paragraphs of one instruction, when there are as many instructions as are in this case, that might be helpful to the jury.
It might be helpful, but I don't think it's reversible error not to do that. By specific instance, they might have been asking, do we have to agree on a specific date? And that certainly isn't required, so answering yes wouldn't have been an accurate response. Certainly within his discretion to refer them back to the instructions as a whole, which were correct. And finally, turning to the 404B ruling, I really believe that the issue that's being raised on appeal, that it was some sort of constitutional violation as to the order of testimony, was not preserved below. There was a lot of discussion about the scope of the trial court's 404B ruling and the application of it, but never once did defense counsel say, wait a minute, Your Honor, your ruling is affecting the order of my testimony in an unconstitutional way.
Well, if it's a constitutional error and it was prejudicial, why can't they raise it for the first time on appeal anyway?
I don't think it's a constitutional error. It would only be a constitutional error if they can point to highly relevant evidence that was actually excluded because of the trial court's ruling.
Mr. Melendrez has attempted to cast this as a Sixth Amendment issue.
Yes, but it's only a Sixth Amendment issue if they can point to relevant evidence that was excluded, not the order in which it was presented.
What case says that?
Menendrez case from California.
Or a Washington case or a U.S. Supreme Court case?
Well, certainly. Well, so you have the Brooks case from the U.S. Supreme Court, which says you can't have a statute that always requires the defendant to testify first. But certainly there's plenty of federal cases and cases from other jurisdictions that that have distinguished that. That doesn't mean that the trial court still doesn't have the authority to make foundational rulings that will affect the order of testimony
maybe
and the order of the defendant's
testimony.
Maybe
there's a reason for this, but ER 611A says that trial judges are empowered to exercise reasonable control over the methods and order of proof. Why doesn't that cover it? You haven't argued that, so I'm trying to figure out what's missing. Why isn't 611A just control the judge gets to reasonably tell people within reason whatever order their witnesses will testify, and they just have to live with it?
Well, yeah, it has to be reasonable. Yes, I think it does cover it.
Is there a reason you didn't argue it? Is there something in the analysis that doesn't fit?
No.
Okay.
No. So there was plenty of evidence that came in, both as a misbehavior that the defendant was aware of, that he claimed was the reason for, I think not very credibly, the reason for the really severe restrictions that the victim was placed under, including basically being pulled out of school twice and being forced to attend an online school. There was other evidence that was outside that 404B ruling that came in anyway, and there was plenty of evidence. This was part of a kind of trash the victim strategy that's common in these cases that was employed throughout trial and I think was employed in the defense brief as well. And I think it's notable that in the defense brief there's nothing about the DNA evidence, which was extremely probative. You have significant amounts of sperm, the defendant's sperm, in the victim's underwear.
Are you making a harmless error argument now?
No, I'm just pointing out what the evidence was.
What the DNA evidence was.
It could matter.
Well, it would only matter if you're saying that the rest of the evidentiary rulings, if wrong, were harmless.
If there was some, yes.
And I just asked you if you're making a harmless error argument. You told me no.
Well, I would be making a harmless error argument if I thought there was any error. Certainly the DNA, all these trial, you know, the completeness of the testimony is an important fact for the court to be aware of. And this wasn't just a credibility contest between the victim and the defendant. There was significant and extremely probative forensic evidence that supported the defendant, the victim's account that her father had sex with her that morning.
Thank you. Just quickly.
So Rule 611A says the trial judge gets to exercise control over the order of proof. Are you arguing that 611A is unconstitutional?
I'm not arguing that that is unconstitutional.
So it would
that
be
rule.
An abuse of discretion standard, right?
No, I'm arguing that in this case it was unconstitutional to require Mr. Melendrez to testify out of order.
Why? That the Rule 611A says the judge can do just that.
It wasn't argued by the state. I don't have it in front of me, but the exact language. But I don't think, I mean, I think that certainly the case law indicates that it has to do with whether or not that the court's decision was valid, and here it was not.
And what particular cases are you relying on?
Well, I mean, in particular, I think Jones is applicable here, because that's what we're talking about in terms of ruling on the relevant evidence.
But in Jones, the defendant was not able to put on any evidence, correct?
He wasn't. But in this case, Mr. Melendrez was required to testify first and earlier than he otherwise may have.
But Jones didn't testify, I mean, didn't address the order of the testimony.
Doesn't specifically address that, no.
What difference does it make whether or not he testified when he wanted to or not?
Well, and I think in part there has been this sort of,
I mean, order that to happen because of some constitutional reason, you must be saying that the rule that allows for the judge to do that's unconstitutional.
Well, in part, I think that has to do with what we're talking about in terms of Brooks v. Tennessee. I mean, there is also this Fifth Amendment.
Well, that's a statute that says it's always got to testify.
And that case was certainly different, but the idea behind it is
that would be offensive. That would even be offensive to trial judges, who would rather have the discretion to run their courtrooms and tell people when the judge is going to let them testify. So there wasn't much of a lobby, probably, for that statute when it came up to the Supreme Court.
But either,
it's a lot different.
I can say this, then. Either way that it's framed,
it was improper for the trial court to determine this wasn't
Mr. Melendrez's
relevant evidence.
Scheduling his own witnesses, and he needed to backfill time so there wasn't dead space in trial.
But he would not have had to have done that if he hadn't had to testify earlier. If he could have testified at the end, then that may not have occurred. We don't know, because the court was saying to him, you need to testify first.
We don't know either. And he didn't have to testify first. He only had to provide evidence of knowledge before other evidence came in.
That's right.
And the court didn't say the evidence of knowledge had to come from Mr. Melendrez, did it?
No, it did not say it specifically had to come from him.
So are we really saying we object to the judge requiring a foundation before evidence came in?
No, that's not what I'm saying. Because the proper foundation could have been laid by other witnesses.
But it wasn't.
But it could have been if that was not the trial court's reasoning. If I could just have 1 second to point out the fact that at RP 1149, RM is cross-examined as to this issue and denies all of it. So I just wanted to point that out as well. Thank you.
Our next case this morning is